And a good Wednesday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. Don't forget that you can take the show with you 24/7 by checking out the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app. You can also listen online by visiting the website nickcraig.com. Our show this morning is brought to you in part by The Law Group. Check them out online at lawgroupnc.com. More from them coming up later in the program this morning. Well, good Wednesday morning to you. And we start off with some what I will call very disappointing news for Republicans in North Carolina. And no, it's not the Supreme Court election. We talked about that yesterday. It's Senator Tom Tillis. This has been an ongoing battle that Republicans in North Carolina have been dealing with for quite some time. I mean, you can even go back to his last election and the frustration and issues with Senator Tom Tillis. He has once again torpedoed himself into the national news cycle going against President Donald Trump. And this has been a long time issue with Tillis. And there's going to be some things I say on the show today that folks are probably not going to sign off or co-sign or agree upon. But there's just this is a situation where Republicans in North Carolina have a serious discussion that they need to have and a serious debate as to how the state goes forward with one of our two U.S. senators. Senator Tillis has been making news over the last 2 days or so. He is a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, faces what is likely to be one of the most expensive United States Senate races that has ever taken place in the country next year, and has informed the White House that he will not support Ed Martin, President Donald Trump's pick to serve as the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, essentially killing Martin's nomination. Martin is currently serving as the interim U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia and has come under strong criticism from individuals like Senator Tom Tillis. Now, let me get a couple of things out of the way here before we get into some of the details on Tillis's Ed Martin decision. Tom Tillis, while he is not the, I would argue in many respects, the picture-perfect conservative or Republican, one thing is for certain, Tom Tillis is better than any Democrat, right? That we know that's a given, right? You look at some of the contenders for the Senate race in 2026, one of the big names that comes to mind is the former governor in Roy Cooper, who is an incredibly popular individual across the state, won two statewide elections by pretty large margins, had a very successful term as governor. Now, when I say successful, I mean politically, a relatively successful term, a very popular guy. Tom Tillis is better than Roy Cooper every single day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. So I don't understand why Senator Tillis feels the need to put Republicans in North Carolina in such a tough spot. There will be primary contenders for Senator Tillis. A couple of them have reached out to me. We're working on the process of getting them scheduled to join the show and discuss their platform and their policy. Here's the reality. Senator Tillis is better than any Democrat. But there's often this tipping point that takes place. And the biggest issue that Tom Tillis is going to face in North Carolina is not that he's not going to get votes from moderates. It's that factions of the Republican Party have watched him do things like the nomination of Pete Hegseth and some of the reports there that he was attempting to torpedo that nomination with, you know, talking to various family members and then discussing that with the big Washington Post exclusive on it. Tillis, for whatever reason, feels the need to insert himself into these controversies that aren't necessary. I am not a fan of Senator Tom Tillis in some of his actions. I'm not. I have voted for him in the past because when you went into a general election back in midterm election back in 2020, and you saw Tillis or Cal Cunningham on the ballot for senator, it was an easy choice. It was an obvious pick for Senator Tillis. Cal Cunningham was a radical progressive Democrat. Tillis was fortunately successful and able to win that election. But there's only so much garbage that Republicans in North Carolina are going to put up with as it relates to one of their two senators. And I fear that tipping point is very close in North Carolina. they constantly see Senator Tillis working against the Trump administration. Now, it's not every time. He is not anti-Trump. He is not constantly trying to stonewall or torpedo the president. But it's enough that it causes voters to question and wonder, why is this guy acting in this manner? Why is he consistently, many times, just in the last 100 days, why is he coming out against President Trump? Why is he actively working against the Republican president? I'll note, a president that has won the state of North Carolina three times, 16, 20, and 24. Nobody can argue that Trump is not a popular figure in the state of North Carolina. He has consistently won this state. Many Trump voters will be asked in November of 2026 to cast a vote for Tom Tillis if he is successful in the primary, which in all likelihood he will be because he's got more money than God. So with that being the case, with those dynamics being the way that they are in North Carolina, I cannot for the life of me wrap my head around why Senator Tillis feels the need to run abject to the president. I don't know why that would be the case. Got some comments coming in on our Rumble chat this morning. Tillis is arrogant in his power. He thinks he's invincible. That might be the case. There's a very real possibility he believes he's untouchable. Now, I mean, if we go back to the 2020 election, I know you've got to kind of roll back your memory a little bit. Cal Cunningham was set to win that election until the controversy came out that he was having an affair. And then he was seen, I believe WRAL captured a video of him leaving his sister's house where he was staying because he was kicked out of his own house by his wife. That pretty much cemented Tillis's victory in that election. So some external factors, no pun intended, caused that election to play out the way that it did. Another comment coming in on Rumble this morning, trying to appease blue hair beta males. Those people hate Tom Tillis too. See, this is the issue with Tillis, is he's not an anti-Trump Republican. He's not a guy that is against everything that Republicans do. That's what makes it so tough. If Tillis was terrible at everything he did, it would be a no-brainer for North Carolinians to say, we don't want this guy and have him not have a successful primary. Right? It'd be a no-brainer. But because he's constantly waffling back and forth on issues, because he does five things that are right in line with the administration, he does five things that are right in line with conservative and Republican ideals, there's a lot of history to look at and a lot of track record to look at and say, yeah, this guy supports a lot of what I do. And then you get to the sixth issue, and it's something like the nomination of Ed Martin, which Tillis has come out and said he is not going to support. And if he was just objectively a bad representative and did nothing that Republicans or conservatives dealt with, then I don't think there'd be much debate. A big name would come forward in the primary, which will be March of next year, and probably would have a strong possibility of beating Tillis. But he's not doing that. And that's why I put a post out on my X account yesterday. If you're not following me over on X and you are a user, I encourage you to check out my platform. I'm at Nicholas M. Craig on X. And my post was pretty simple. It's just one line. Tillis is putting a lot of Republicans across North Carolina in a very tough spot. And I believe that. I believe he is putting individuals in North Carolina that want to support somebody like Tom Tillis, want to make sure that a Republican is successful in winning the general election. Here's the thing, and this is something that is probably going to piss a lot of you off, but I feel the need to say it. I feel like I have a moral duty to say so. Winning the primary doesn't matter. We have seen in past election cycles, just go back to our last gubernatorial race, winning the primary doesn't matter. If you are incapable of winning in the general election, your win in the primary is useless. I don't care how strong of a candidate you are in the primary. If you are incapable of winning a general election, then it doesn't matter. You don't get a trophy for winning the primary and then getting blown out in the general election like Mark Robinson did by 14 points. There's no prize for that. There's no great moral victory that you receive. You have absolutely no governing ability when you destroy in a primary and then get annihilated in the general election. And this is something that Republicans fail to wrap their head around in North Carolina, and it's incredibly frustrating. The most popular pick in the primary is not necessarily the best candidate in the general election. Mark Robinson, if you need a, you can't find a better example than his campaign. A guy that a lot of Republicans refuse to vote for. Many, many Republicans refuse to vote for. Go look at the totals. Go look at the Trump election. Go look at some of the other Council of State elections, and then look at the race between Josh Stein and Mark Robinson. That data, those numbers prove very clearly that there were plenty of Republicans, people I know personally, very close friends, staunch conservatives, that refused to vote for Mark Robinson for a variety of issues, whether it was his horrific track record as the lieutenant governor, where he didn't do anything, couldn't even be bothered to show up to his job as a member of the Council of State, couldn't be bothered to show up to the North Carolina Senate to preside. From that to all of the various controversies surrounding him, I don't think Mark Robinson's a bad guy, but he was an awful general election candidate. Josh Stein annihilated him in the general election. It's the worst gubernatorial loss for one political party in almost 50 years in North Carolina. It goes to show you how bad of a candidate in the general election Mark Robinson was. So when this discussion, which is unfolding right now and will continue in the coming months as we get closer to the end of the year and more individuals throw their hat into the race against Tom Tillis, the real question is not who can win in the primary, because again, that's irrelevant. Who can beat somebody like potentially Governor Roy Cooper? Who can beat somebody like a Cal Cunningham who ran against Tillis in 2020? The state of North Carolina is going to have so much outside money flowing into it, is going to have so many blue dollars from states like New York and California bankrolling their candidate, whoever it ends up being, that Republicans need to make sure that they have the best candidate possible. That candidate might be Tillis, it might be somebody else. Susan is commenting over on our Rumble this morning. She says, we must have a candidate who can raise the money, inspire the vote, unify the NCGOP, and beat Cooper. Absolutely. All of those things are prerequisites to running and winning. And I'm not, the whole point of this morning is not to say, don't vote for Tillis or vote for somebody else or don't vote for this. That's not the point. I'm simply laying out the various pieces of this equation that equal a successful election victory and potentially a successful second half of the Trump administration. Right, when you look at these midterm elections coming up next year, there is a strong possibility that Republicans do not retain control of the House and the Senate. There's a very strong possibility of that. Midterm elections traditionally do not play out well for the party that is currently in power. That's just how it goes. That's always how it's gone. And so when you look at the pivotal U.S. Senate, North Carolina Senate seat is likely to be the top. This Senate race is probably going to be one of the most looked after anywhere in the nation. And as I mentioned, could be one of the most expensive Senate races by far that the state's ever seen. Could end up being one of the most expensive Senate races in the United States of America. And so having a candidate that can raise money and actually beat a Democrat is important. Again, is that person Tillis? As of this morning, I think a lot of Republicans would say, hell no. I think a lot of Republicans would say, why? Why would we vote for this guy? And I find myself very frustrated as somebody that wants to support Tillis. Not because he's a unbelievably staunch conservative, but because he has the stamina to win a general election and has the track record of beating a Democrat in the general election. I want to support Tillis. I do. Why is he making it so freaking hard for me to support him? Why is he putting me in a position where I have to start finding and looking at alternative candidates? Tillis has got the money. He's got the name ID. He's got the track record and the ability to win. So why is he making my life so freaking complicated as it relates to his Senate reelection next year? He wants to block Trump's nomination. And this is of Ed Martin. This is what the senator had to say yesterday morning on Capitol Hill. Hear it directly from the horse's mouth. Don't take my word for it.
He is, I don't believe he's being advanced to the markup. I met with Mr. Martin. He seems like a good man. Most of my concerns related to January 6th. And he built a compelling case on some of the 15, 12 prosecutions that were probably heat of the moment, bad decisions. But where we probably have a difference is I think anybody that breached the perimeter should have been in prison for some period of time, whether it's 30 days or 3 years is debatable. But I have no tolerance for anybody who entered the building on January the 6th. And that's probably where most of the friction was.
I see. So he disagreed with you on that?
Well, no, I have to say that Mr. Martin did a good job of explaining how there were people that probably got caught up in it. But they made the stupid decision to come through a building that had been breached and that the police officers and others were saying, stay away. So the difference wasn't that they should be charged, in my estimation, it's by how much. That's an argument I'm willing to have, but we have to be very, very clear that what happened on January the 6th was wrong. It wasn't, it was not prompted or created by other people to put those people in trouble. They made a stupid decision and they disgraced the United States by absolutely destroying the Capitol, and I can't have any patience.
It sounds like your concerns were not alleviated.
But let me be very clear, though. Mr. Martin did a good job of explaining the one area that I think he's probably right, that there were some people that were over-prosecuted. But there were some, 200 or 300 of them, that should have never gotten a pardon, and he agreed with that. But the disagreement there had more to do. If Mr. Martin were being put forth as a U.S. attorney for any district except the district where January 6th happened, the protest happened, I'd probably support him, but not in this district.
When you say he's not being advanced to the markup, was he operating under that understanding that he's not being advanced through to a markup?
Well, I think Mr. Martin, I'm sure they're looking through it. I mean, be clear, some of the deadline has to do with the length of time he can operate as acting, and the administration can work through that if they want to have more time and potentially work them through. But at this point, I've indicated to the White House I wouldn't support his nomination.
God, why? I mean, like, I want to support Tillis. I mean this genuinely. I'm disregarding everything else. Just speaking as a regular voter in North Carolina, a guy that wants to win, a guy that wants to see Republicans continue to have success, not only in the state, but in Washington, D.C. Why is Tillis making my life so freaking complicated? I mean, that's at the root of the discussion this morning. He says, he'd support him for any other district besides D.C. That doesn't make any freaking sense. You either support the guy or you don't. You either think he's capable of being a U.S. district attorney or not. Regardless of the district he's operating in, that makes absolutely no sense to me at all. Says he had a good meeting with him. Says that he agreed with him on a lot of things, but he just can't get over this one thing. Here's the reality of politics. And I've mentioned this to you before. You're not always going to get everything that you want. Not everything is 100% you get what you want. And so I guess Senator Tillis, in his mind, believes that a Democrat is better in this position than a Republican. I don't agree with that. The Trump administration doesn't agree with that. Voters in North Carolina do not agree with that. You don't have to love everything that you do in politics. Sometimes you just have to plug your nose and vote for things. You do. That's the reality of it. We don't have kings in the United States of America. We are not a one person rules all. We've got a president. We've got a judicial wing. We've got a congressional wing, and they all work together. Right? Obviously, the judicial doesn't directly work with them, but things have to be lawful and things have to be constitutional, so on and so forth. Right? So there's a process. And not everything is perfect. Not everything gets you 100% of what you want. That's just the fact of politics. Senator Tillis knows this. Senator Tillis has been in government long enough to know that sometimes, even though you don't love the guy, even though you don't think that he is 100% perfect for the position, politics is not perfection. It's just not the name of the game. Now, if it was one person rules all, it would be perfect for that individual because they're solely in charge of everything. But that's not how a democratic republic like the United States operates. We don't have one man or one woman rule. Everybody's got to work together. And the fact that you've got a couple of senators, including Senator Tom Tillis, that are blocking and have announced publicly that they are going to block the nomination of Ed Martin. There's four individuals on the list. Tillis, John Cornyn out of Texas, Susan Collins out of Maine, no surprise with her, and Bill Cassidy out of Louisiana. These four individuals have stated publicly that they're not going to support Trump's pick. And I think it's a terrible decision. I think it puts Republicans in North Carolina in a very tough spot as they roll around to next year. The fact is very simple. And again, you're probably not going to agree with me, but I'm not here to blow smoke up your ass. I'm here to tell you what I believe. Senator Tillis is likely to win his primary. There is a very, very, very strong likelihood that with his name ID, his influence, and by the sheer amount of money that he can raise, that he is likely to win his primary. That's just a fact. Don't shoot the messenger. Don't take it out on me. It's not my fault. Just looking at the factors the way that they stand right now. Tillis, unless some major names get thrown into the race, Tillis is likely to probably handedly win his primary. And so let's assume that's the case. What do Republicans do come November of next year? If Tillis is still up in Washington, D.C., and he will be at the time, working in abject to President Trump's agenda, not working to confirm President Trump's picks in the case of the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Ed Martin. We saw him almost torpedo the Hegseth nomination. Fortunately, he ended up coming around on that. That was ended up being a good vote for the senator. Ended up being a smart decision on his behalf. But man, I just don't get it with Tillis. I don't understand why this continues to happen with him. Why he continues to put himself in these positions and put Republicans in North Carolina in this position. There's going to be a lot of names that run. That's going to be one of the reasons why Tillis is likely to win. You're going to have probably a half a dozen, if not more, individuals throw their hat into the race. It's going to dilute the vote, and Tillis will squeak through without a problem. That's the likelihood of what happens in this primary. There's already multiple Republicans that have announced their bids to run against Tillis. Many of them on the same conservative side of the aisle, and themselves will be eating each other for votes. That opens the pathway for somebody like Tillis to just walk right through the open door. And now, then, of course, what happens on the Democrat side? Is it somebody like a Roy Cooper? Is it somebody like a Jeff Jackson that ends up running for this? Somebody that is very, very progressive in their ideology and put Republicans in a position next November where what they end up doing is not voting in the contest. They leave that race blank, which, by the way, will be on the top of the ticket in 2026 here in North Carolina. They will just leave that election blank. And with that, it opens the door for a Republican to unseat Senator Tillis and potentially unseat Republican control in the United States Senate. Right. Those are all of the factors that play into this. I know there's been a lot of people that have been calling Tillis's office, seen a lot of conversation on social media about that. I think that's a great idea. I think you should be calling your representative, emailing your representatives, and making sure that they understand that these people are responsible and accountable to voters in North Carolina. I want to support somebody like Tillis. He is an effective person in Washington, D.C. most of the time. I really do want to support him, but God, he makes it impossible to do it sometimes. So this is set to be a long-term debate, a primary March of next year. We'll keep an eye on it, and hopefully Tillis has some change of heart. Maybe Trump can tighten the screws on him a little bit and convince him to come around. But as it stands right now, it seems like he is pretty squarely against Ed Martin for a U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, a big blow to the administration and a tough pill for a lot of Republicans across the state of North Carolina to swallow here this morning. So we'll keep an eye on it. Again, I don't have the answers. There's no good solution here. The reality is there's not strong contenders to beat somebody like Tillis as it stands right now. You know, there's, of course, the name that continues to be talked about is, you know, does somebody like Dan Bishop step forward? Somebody who's got a lot of name ID, somebody that can raise money and has had the support of President Trump. And that's another big question in all of this. With potentially this vote against Ed Martin, does Trump look for a different candidate to support? Right? That's one of the wild card factors in all of this. And what if Trump does say support Tillis? Then what do Republicans do? Then what happens? There's a lot of moving parts in all of this. I don't have the answers for all of it. We'll keep an eye on it right here and pass any news or details. And again, as I noted, there are multiple candidates that have announced they are primarying Tillis. Some of them have reached out to me. We're going to be working on scheduling and getting them on the show here in the coming weeks and months to get their message out there and discuss the important issues and why they believe that they are best suited for that position in the United States Senate, bringing you that coverage right here on the Nick Craig Show. Well, our coverage is only possible thanks to the great support of our advertisers and our Patreons. I'd like to tell you about our friends over at the Law Group in Wilmington this morning. When legal challenges arise, make sure that you trust the Law Group in Wilmington. Since 2003, their experienced attorneys have provided high-quality, affordable legal services across Eastern North Carolina. Whether you're facing a divorce, navigating real estate transactions, or need a strong defense, the Law Group has your back. Their dedicated team ensures your questions are answered and issues are resolved as promptly as possible. They're located in downtown Wilmington and just a phone call away at 910-251-6088. You can visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. That's 910-251-6088 or online at lawgroupnc.com. The Law Group, experience and dedication you can rely on. I bought my house actually coming up on 5 years this July and was able to use the great legal services over at the Law Group to go through that process of purchasing my house. Again, give them a call, 910-251-6088, or visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. We appreciate their continued support of the Nick Craig Show. And if you are in need of any legal services, make sure you give the Law Group a call. Some fiery back and forth in Washington, D.C. yesterday between Kristi Noem and Democrats over FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. We'll have details on that coming up here in just a few minutes as the Nick Craig Show continues on a Wednesday morning live on YouTube, Rumble, and X, and 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. And welcome back to the Nick Craig Show. Good Wednesday morning to you. Thanks for joining us live or via podcast. Taking a look at some other news that we are tracking across the United States this morning. Some major blowups in Congress yesterday as Kristi Noem made her way in front of the House. She will be in front of the Senate tomorrow, Thursday, as she goes and speaks to lawmakers as the Homeland Security Secretary testifies on border security. However, Democrats bringing up other issues because, again, Democrats don't really have any issues to run on right now. They don't really have any major popular policy standpoints. So they're trying to rewrite history, rewrite the past, and try and change things that, you know, people believe and think. This conversation features radical Democrats from the state of California and Kristi Noem over FEMA. Take a listen to this exchange.
My ask of you is, what is your plan with regard to FEMA? Are you planning to eliminate FEMA? Your testimony references that you want to, quote, eliminate dysfunction of the current agency. I'm unclear. I don't know if my colleagues are clear on what you mean by dysfunction. And I'm concerned that you're causing more dysfunction within the workforce that should be preparing itself for the pending hurricane season.
Now, let me stop right there from the great Democrat from Connecticut with the purple hair. FEMA is completely dysfunctional. Do you need any more greater examples than what you saw with Hurricane Helene in Western North Carolina? Do you need any greater example than what you saw with Hurricane Milton in portions of Southwest Florida? FEMA, as a federal agency, has been a mess. FEMA, as a federal agency, is too top-heavy, has way too much money spent on bureaucracy and bloat and administration and all the other crap and garbage that government loves to waste money on. And when it really comes down to it, FEMA does not do a great job of doing what they should do, which is immediate response to natural disasters and the aftermath of natural disasters like hurricanes. So let's see what Kristi Noem has to say about this.
Well, thank you for your question and the discussion on this topic today. President Trump has been very clear since the beginning that he believes that FEMA and its response in many, many circumstances has failed the American people, and that FEMA as it exists today should be eliminated and empowering states to respond to disasters with federal government support.
With all due respect, where is the evidence of the failure of FEMA? I don't know about everybody else. On this, my state, Connecticut, was hit very, very hard with Superstorm Sandy.
Superstorm Sandy, as she talks about it, hit in 2012. So that was, 13 years ago. So the idea that, FEMA may have done a good job 13 years ago as it related to the state of Connecticut with a anticyclonic storm known as Sandy. Is not what just happened. I mean, Representative DeLorio does not remember the story, or I guess maybe never read the stories about FEMA actively discriminating against individuals that are conservative and Republican, actively discriminating against individuals if they had Trump signs or flags in their front yard. I mean, somebody was fired over this. So what are the examples of FEMA's response? How about towns requesting supplies days in advance only to have FEMA slow walk the process because of government red tape, bureaucracy, and bloat? But it wasn't FEMA or any sort of federal government or, hell, even the state government that was the first responder to many scenarios in Western North Carolina. It was private civilians. It was private charity groups and private response groups. The Cajun Navy, they made their way up to North Carolina to help rescue folks that were stranded and trapped in Western North Carolina. It wasn't FEMA. Now, let's be clear. FEMA is not a on-the-ground agency where they've got, soldiers and people that are dealing with that stuff. No, they use state and National Guard members to do some of that work. But there are clear issues and failures of FEMA that happened just only 8 or 9 months ago, just last hurricane season. They mismanaged their budget. They pissed away a bunch of money housing illegal immigrants and then cried to Congress that they were out of money. So what do you mean there's no issues with FEMA? I mean, what rock are you sleeping under?
Every community in some way or another has been hit by that. And the FEMA on the ground, people come in, work with the families, deal with getting the funding out. Where is the evidence of the failure of FEMA?
Congresswoman, we still have claims open from Hurricane Katrina. We have fire claims that are still unpaid to people who said they were due them 7 to 8 to 10 years old. They have never been paid by FEMA. So one of the worst things that the federal government can do is to stand up in front of the American public and say, we will be there. We will walk alongside you in the most horrible time of your life, and then never follow through on it.
Well, that's
what the president has said is he's sick and tired of federal agencies that pick and choose who wins and who loses. He wants to make sure that the federal government's commitment, when it makes a commitment, that it follows through. So he's going to empower states.
The federal government is abdicating its commitment to the American people who find themselves.
It did certainly under Joe Biden's administration.
Let me just say this to you. The Office of Professional Responsibility. The Office of Professional, because I knew you were going to go there. As you know, FEMA's Office of Professional Responsibility, under the Biden administration, there was no evidence, no direction or agency or field leadership to discriminate against disaster victims based on political affiliation, which was a charge.
I'll follow up with you.
Well, and I will follow up. I will follow up, and I'll follow up with my colleagues, quite frankly, and to really listen to people whose states, communities have been devastated, and what role FEMA has played. I don't know how many millions and millions of dollars went out in Louisiana. Actually, I've asked my staff to calculate that when Katrina hit. And the response was overwhelming. And the response has been overwhelming. If you want to make corrections, that's fine. We all agree with that.
Yeah, we can point to thousands and thousands of air.
Well, if you wouldn't mind getting this committee, the information and the evidence where you talk about the dysfunction of the agency and where it has really failed, that would be important to those of us who are appropriating dollars. And it would appear that the administration overall has a way in which they're looking at dismantling the federal government. The states will never have the amount of money because the federal government isn't going to pass that money to the states to be able to deal with what happens. It's when the federal government comes in and be able to give a hand to do that. And I think it's very clear from what you said that both yourself and the president really want to dismantle the federal government and the agencies that have provided service to the American people for decades. I thank the chair for your time and yield back.
Jesus. I mean, what a rambling lunatic. There's no examples of issues with FEMA. She just completely dispelled the FEMA employee that blew the whistle, provided screenshots to news entities about FEMA actively discriminating against individuals based on their political affiliation. This lady is freaking nuts. I mean, she's absolutely crazy. You look at the dysfunction within the federal government, it's all over the place. It's consistent. It's part of government. And you have the representative from Connecticut making the claim that states can't handle this themselves because we need the might of the federal government. No, you need the money from the federal government. The whole discussion around FEMA has been a relatively simple one, all things considered. FEMA has an incredible amount of bloat and expenses at the top for administration and bureaucracy that exists within an agency like FEMA. The discussion has been had and is happening right now that, well, what if we took that money and instead of pissing it away on salaries for government bureaucrats, we just wrote blank checks to state governments who are on the ground, who know how relief needs to be handled for their community so that they don't have to wait years, months, and years for the federal government to actually provide them what they need. I think that's a fair discussion. Is it the right discussion? Is it the right solution? I think in some part, yes. I think the more and more that you can cut bloat out of DC as it relates to actually interfacing with the American public, the better services are. If after Hurricane Helene, FEMA announced that they were going to be appropriating X amount of dollars to the state of North Carolina. That would have helped lawmakers as they were going through the process of doling out aid. Of course, you know, having to spend state dollars first. And a lot of the delays have taken place because state government doesn't want to get ahead of the federal government and lose out on federal matching. That has been said by members in the North Carolina General Assembly, specifically Senate Leader Phil Berger, has made the point that we are waiting to spend certain amount of dollars because if we get ahead of the federal government, we lose all the federal money. We lose the federal match. We lose, you know, the 100% federal funding if we spend it before they do. Why might the state government spend it before the federal government? Because things take forever. The federal government is bloated and slow. And she's using examples of Hurricane Katrina was a freaking mess. And that was in 2008. Talking almost 20 years ago. Superstorm Sandy, 2012. How about some more recent examples of FEMA? We do, unfortunately, have those recent examples. Hurricane season starts next month. Us here in eastern North Carolina, going to be keeping an eye on the tropics for the vast majority of the rest of the year. Looking at what's forming out there, what's going on, and the impacts that it can have on places like southeastern North Carolina. And unfortunately, we've got other issues in the state as well, right? Because we've seen under previous Democrat control, specifically Democrat Governor Roy Cooper, his NCOR, the North Carolina Office of Recovery and Resiliency, did a terrible job as it related to Hurricane Matthew and Hurricane Florence. You still have people that are waiting for their homes to be remediated from mold almost a decade after those storms hit. You have individuals that have been living in temporary housing at the expense of North Carolina tax dollars, in some cases for 7 or 8 years. And so hurricane relief or natural disaster relief, it's traditionally hurricanes here in North Carolina, is not a one-size-fits-all solution. There's not one thing that magically fixes relief. But I feel like I can say pretty confidently this morning that the more and more that you disconnect and divorce the federal government and all of the red tape and the bloat and the bureaucracy that exists there and get money faster and quicker to people that are on the ground, people that geographically know the area, people that know exactly what needs to be spent first as it relates to hurricane funds, the better the response is going to be. I don't see the negative. Now, if the discussion from the Trump administration was, we're going to defund FEMA and we're not going to provide any money to the states for any sort of natural disaster relief, that would be a big problem because state governments don't have the reserves or the ability to spend the kind of money that is needed after these horrific natural disasters occur. Hurricane Helene is estimated to cost anywhere between $60 and $80 billion in impact. Now, that's not direct money, right? That includes lost time, lost production, economic impact, between $60 and $80 billion. The state does not have even billions of dollars sitting aside, let alone tens of billions of dollars just sitting around and waiting. Now, fortunately, due to strong Republican control in North Carolina, we do have a nice rainy day fund that now's got, I think, a $1.2 or $1.4 billion in it. So that's good. It's good to have that money available for immediate rapid response. But the state governments don't have that kind of money. But that's not what the Trump administration is advocating for. They're not advocating for the federal government to completely divorce itself from natural disaster relief. What they're trying to do, and everything, and this is what I've heard from the president himself with his visit to Western North Carolina back in, it was early February, 2 weeks after he was sworn in, for his first visit after being re-brought into the White House, after being inaugurated on January the 20th, was to Western North Carolina, his very first visit, leaving the White House, leaving the District of Columbia. And he has made the point that FEMA at its current form is broken. for a variety of issues. But as I mentioned before, I played that clip, the rewriting of history is a big issue for me. You've got this purple-haired representative from Congress that is yelling at Kristi Noem that she doesn't have any evidence. And there are stories after stories after stories about FEMA discriminating. We've written about it in multiple places. I mean, it's all over the place. You just do a Google search for FEMA Trump signs. Here's an NPR article. FEMA worker fired for telling hurricane responders to avoid homes with pro-Trump signs. It's an NPR story. So how can she claim it's not happening? How can she claim that it's never happened if there's no evidence of it? I mean, it's literally right here. Now, does that mean the entire agency is doing that? No, but nobody's saying the entire agency is. Why is it that the left is so abject to looking at various facets of the federal government? We're talking about FEMA this morning, but it's all over the place. Why is it that Democrats are so against looking at things in the federal government and saying, can this thing be fixed? Can this thing be done in a more efficient, effective manner? I mean, you look at private business. They ask themselves that question constantly. Maybe it's every couple of quarters. They look at the books. They look at the things that they're doing. Can we improve on this? Can we change this? Can we modify procedures? Can we do whatever to make our product better, to do whatever? Why can't we do that with the federal government? Why is it always an existential threat when these discussions take place at the federal level? Are we under the auspices that the federal government is perfect? That there are no serious concerns or questions within the federal government? That everything is just chugging along at the best possible rate possible? That everything is hunky-dory? That there's not a whole bunch of red tape, bureaucracy, and bloat in the federal government? Why is it always a threat to democracy? The answer is very simple. Democrats don't want change. Democrats are unwilling to look at failures of the federal government, of which there are plenty, and figure out how we move past those things. And how we get to a position where the federal government is doing a better job responding to their constituents. Responding to the people that they represent. And you've heard me mention this a lot. You and I don't get a choice as to whether we fund FEMA. You and I don't get a choice as to whether we pay for federal relief. That money is extracted from your paycheck every month, is extracted quarterly from your paycheck, and is sucked up into Washington, D.C. for them to decide what they want to spend money on. And it creates some big-time questions when you read stories about FEMA discriminating against individuals based on their political ideology. When you read stories about resources being requested by FEMA and days-long delays before that those resources are responded to in the western half of North Carolina, there is a very real and valid concern. Democrats want to rewrite history. They want to bury their head in the sand on the issue. But it's the truth. There is evidence of it. I'm not sure why Kristi Noem has to provide that to members of Congress when a simple rudimentary Google search will show exactly and provide them exactly what they're looking for. Trump is shaking up the federal government. He is making significant changes to the way in which government operates. He is taking a microscope to all of these federal agencies and saying, can the work be done better? Can the work be done more efficiently, right? Isn't that the whole purpose of DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency? Figure out Maybe the current way FEMA's set up is the best way that relief can be done. Maybe it is. I don't think it is, but I think it's worth the discussion. Why would we not want to discuss that? Why would we not want to have a good-natured discussion over, are we handling relief for citizens in our various states and municipalities in the best possible manner? Why is that inherently a bad thing? I don't know. You can't ask Republicans. You have to ask Democrats, who are against everything that this administration is standing for. And for what? I don't know. I guess it makes a good political talking point. Gives them the opportunity to show their voters and show to their constituents that they're fighting the man. Seems incredibly short-sighted and stupid. There will be changes coming to FEMA, or at least recommendations coming for FEMA. If those changes come to fruition, well, we'll just have to wait and see. Not immediately clear. Well, it is a busy morning over in Vatican City as all eyes are on the conclave to elect the next pope, as that has been taking place. There was a mass earlier this morning, and as we head into the later part of today, 133 cardinal electors from all over the world will gather under the Sistine Chapel for the voting of the next pope for the Roman Catholic Church. Those individuals are barred from leaving the facility. They have zero contact with the outside world. Their phones have been taken. Cell phone jamming equipment has been installed in and around the Vatican so that there is no outside communication, and they are required to vote and vote and vote until somebody gets a two-thirds majority of the 133 cardinals that are currently in the Vatican. And I believe as it was just as of a couple of hours ago, were attending a mass. They were then having lunch, and then after that were set to make their way into the room to begin the process of voting. From the reports that I read earlier this morning, you could have some of those votes take, or at least just one vote that will be taking place today. That will happen somewhere around 7 to 8 p.m. in the Vatican. So that'll be mid-afternoon here on the East Coast. Obviously, that smokestack will be watched. Black smoke means that the vote was not successful, that somebody did not secure two-thirds of the ballots. And white smoke obviously means that somebody has, and that the next pope has been decided on. One vote today, and then four votes every single day going forward until the 133 cardinals, the largest papal conclave ever, decide who is going to be leading the Catholic Church going forward. That is taking place in the Vatican this morning and throughout the day today. We'll continue to track those details as well and provide them as soon as we get them. Well, that's going to do it for a Wednesday edition of the Nick Craig Show. Thanks for joining us live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X, 7 o'clock each and every weekday morning, and of course 24/7 wherever you get your podcast. Thanks again to the Law Group here in Wilmington for their support of the show. You can visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. We're back with you tomorrow morning right here on the Nick Craig Show. Have a great Wednesday.